You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Summer is often a time for family vacations, and for the Porter family, that means their home in the fictional beach community of Ushant Point on Buzzards Bay in Massachusetts. The Porters are at the heart of Elizabeth Graber's fourth novel, The End of the Point, which unfolds over the course of five decades and through four different generations. She was on our show back in March to talk about the novel, and we thought that with the unofficial start of the summer season this holiday weekend, we would re-air it for you today. I began by noting that the Porters are descendants of the governor of Plymouth Colony, and you get the sense that the family had been going to Ushant Point since the very beginning. So I asked Elizabeth Graber, were you interested in exploring how a place can shape a person or a family?
Very much so. I was interested in both how a place can form a family and also how a family can form a place. So the intersections between this place that really doesn't change very much but is also located inside history and a wider world all the time, and then this family that also in certain ways resists change but is out in the world, that dynamic fascinates me.
Well, they seem to, on the one hand, want change, embrace it, and then the next they resist it. But you can always take one of those wonderful old houses and gut it and change it into something else. It does remain the constant in this story. Now, you relate six transitional decades of the Porter family's history in three sections through different characters, both first and third person. So how did you come to make those decisions? Why tell this one in first person, why that in third?
Well, originally I had many more characters, and it started even farther back. So part of it was just finding an architecture that I thought worked. I think the only first-person section is all letters and diaries, and I found myself in this book. It begins in 1942 and ends in 1999, and I was really interested in writing in it and in the ways in which people are communicating through writing in ways that are increasingly rare in the 21st century. So I love the idea of just thinking about diaries, letters, the kind of materiality of communication. There's no Wi-Fi in my book. You know, it's of a different time, and I think that materiality and the first person voice of a letter or a diary, which can be a little awkward, or it's not the writer's voice, it's not the narrator's voice, and I was interested in the kind of possibilities of that first person, but I didn't want it all the way through because this really is a book with a kind of omniscient narrator who's sweeping over a lot of time.
Also rare is a multi-generational novel these days. We don't see a lot of them. They used to be much more popular form. Did you set out to do that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was very interested, again, in the kaleidoscopic nature of what I was trying to do. So I didn't want it to be set in one time period or from one perspective, because I think for me, at the heart of this book are questions about point of view, really. You know, what is it like to be an insider or an outsider? So there's a nanny, or they call her a children's nurse, who's Scottish, who comes to this place, and it's not her place, but she comes back and back and back. Then there are children born into the place for whom it's really their lifeblood. One of the characters calls it a second mother at one point. So without those points of view, I think I would have had a much more singular vision. And the same thing with the time. So it's set in World War II and during the Vietnam War and in the 90s. That interested me.
And I read a quote from you where you said you wanted to portray a small place but go deep, to use a narrow lens to examine larger issues of social class, money, and property, of parenting and caretaking, of what adults pass on both literally and figuratively to children. How much of this is one reviewer described it as a family symphony in four movements with a prelude. Were you thinking in musical terms?
No, I would never have called my novel a symphony, although it's
because people have structured books with that in mind.
Yeah, I think more probably architecturally. I mean, I think very musically in terms of sentences. The poetry of the work is extremely important to me. I read my work aloud. if something doesn't end on the proper downbeat or upbeat, I'll revise it for sound over sense. So certainly music is in the language in a really deep way for me. But I'm not sure I thought of the structure as I'm not a musician. I thought of it almost more as houses. Alice Munro, who's a writer I love, talks about, you know, when I start a story, it's like going into a house and I don't know until I'm there for a while if I can stay there. And that's really how I wrote this book. I didn't plan ahead very much at the beginning, so I would kind of go in and make a room and then another room. And it took a long time because that process has a lot of error built in, but it felt very place-based, I guess, in the metaphors that I think about it.
But then certain things happened, like you have the eldest children all named Charlie, for example.
Yeah, which is a little confusing. But in this family, they name children Charlie after each other. So,
to some degree, it's also about history repeating itself.
Very much so. Repeating itself, and also how do you make your own way when you have, you know, the first Charlie in my book is a young man who's in World War II, and, well, I won't give away the plot, but
one of the things I thought about in discussing this book is that there are so many potential spoilers.
Yeah.
It's hard to talk about something where you don't want to ruin it for people who you hope will read the book. But what do you do?
You know, I think my book is very character driven, and so in some ways there's plenty that happens, but I would never want to spoil it, but there's a lot of ways in which the kind of themes, I think, of caretaking and I was really interested in just questions of who raises children and how they raise them, and thinking more widely than, you know, the biological mother, thinking of land as a mother, thinking of a nanny as a mother.
But this is not their home. This is their home away from home. It's meant as a respite, despite the fact that throughout the book we have war, death, environmental threats, things that can be found everywhere in life showing up on the point. Does the family experience those events any differently because they're on the point rather than in their home?
That's an interesting question. I think part of what interested me about World War II is that there's a base actually on the point, and this is based on a real thing. My idea for this place is actually very loosely based on an actual place where I've spent time, where an army did come, and you can still see the old foundations, and they built barracks that looked like summer cottages. And
they paved the roads.
And paved the roads. So, you know, improvements or not, depending on how fast you want people to be driving. But there, the war actually comes to roost, and yet nothing happens, but everyone's waiting and waiting. In other ways, at other points in the book, part of it set during the Vietnam War, I see Ashant, my fictional Ashant, as a kind of escape in some really lovely and in some kind of troublesome way. So what does it mean to be able to be somewhere where all your cousins and second cousins are there? And what does it mean to be somewhere where you know the paths, almost like you know your own hand? That's a huge gift, but it also allows for a sort of retracting, I guess.
Well, attitudes toward those two wars were totally different. So during World War II, the older girls in the family are all excited about the soldiers being around. During the Vietnam War, people were marching against the war.
Right, yes. And those were things that were very interesting for me to think about and research.
Now, you mentioned the nanny B, very attached to her charge, the youngest daughter, Janie. And here we wind up again entering into dangerous territory because there are spoilers here.
Right.
But you said that you had no idea that you'd be doing you'd be writing any of those things when you started the book. I mean, did you have any little plot ideas in mind?
Yes, I did a little bit, and partly because this book does have a strange relationship to the real. I always do research in my work, but this book, the nanny character was actually very, very loosely based because I had never met this person and there were no real records about her, hardly any, on a woman who was a, quote, children's nurse in my family, in my husband's family. And I had heard about her for quite a few years, didn't know much about her except that she was very beloved, that she had perhaps had a romance with a soldier in a summer community during World War II, and that she had moved back to Scotland in her retirement. And it was the moving back that was so interesting to me, that someone would come here, spend 50 years with a family, not have her own children, and then go back. So I had a great adventure where I went to her town and poked around and found the real house she bought. And I was
in Scotland.
In Scotland, yeah. You know, it was an excuse to go to
Why not?
Around.
Let's go to Scotland because
yeah.
I have to do research.
That's right. And I made up most of what I found, but I somehow being in the place where my character was from, and I was very lonely there, very isolated. I'd left my family behind. But I kept thinking this was home to her, and where I'm home in New England, because I'm a New Englander, it was not. And it just the reversals of that were fascinating to me.
But B is also part of the family and separate from it. It gives you an opportunity to both look at the family through her insider's eyes and her outsider's eyes.
Right, and that's a great position.
And then the class thing, as you mentioned earlier, because there is an inequity no matter how much the family embraces you.
Right.
Now, the parents are also not exactly the most engaged parents. This is something you've written about before.
Disengaged parents, have I?
I thought...
Certainly complicated parent-child relationships I'm very interested in. It's such an intense relationship. Interestingly, you know, I wrote this book. I now have two children who are 10 and 12. And at the center of this book, in some ways, is the nanny, whereas I wrote a book about a mother and daughter, a 10-year-old daughter, long before I had children of my own. So it's I like to approach it, you know, as you brought up about the point of view in this book, from many, many different angles. But yeah, I think that's one of the most kind of central primitive forming relationships. So I can never get enough of exploring it, I guess.
You also have some disagreeable characters. You like creating people who aren't all that likable?
I do. I mean, what I love is creating complicated characters, I guess, and in a funny way, they're all likable to me because
they're your children.
They're my children. They have their quirks, you know. But yeah, I'm not interested in kind of easy divisions between good and bad. So it's the complexity of them that I find keeps me interested.
Well, do you find yourself at a certain point saying, "Oh, gee, I've been piling it on this character. I've been a little too mean to Helen. Let's say I better pull back and give her something nice here."
Maybe. I'm remembering in my first novel, Unraveling, where I had the central character as a kind of hermit in one strand of it, and she had chickens in her house as her pets, and a good friend of mine, a writer, said, "Give her something furry. Give her a mammal." So I turned them into bunnies, you know.
Hey, you've also written a lot of short stories over the years and been published in some of the, Best American Short Stories, Prize Stories, the O. Henry Awards, the Pushcart Prize Anthology, Best American Essays as well. But let's talk about the difference between short stories. You mentioned Alice Munro, a woman who seems to be able to write a novel within a short
That's
story.
Right.
You're writing a fairly long novel here. Do you see an interplay between the two in your writing life?
Well, this book as a novel actually is closer in some ways to the stories than any of my other novels in that it has separate parts with separate titles. And I do view them, they're not exactly standalone, but I view them as having a kind of almost intermediate form that they're somewhere, they have a kind of selfness they're part of a whole, but they also kind of have their own little structures.
But it's not interconnected short stories.
No, it's really not. I thought it might be at the beginning, and then it became a novel. For me, the process is really different. I tend to write short stories incredibly fast. I go into a kind of fugue state, and out it comes, whereas novels take me forever, I think partly because I don't outline, and I'm going on these hunches, and it just takes a long time to know what I want to say.
And you also have the luxury of digression.
Yes.
A novel that you don't have in short stories.
Yes.
Elizabeth Graver is the author of the novels Awake, The Honey Thief, and Unraveling, and now The End of the Point. It is published by Harper. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Leonard.